more years. He had 4,231 hours in the Eagle, knew all its tricks, and couldn't imagine a better aircraft to go up in. So now he'd kill Chinese. He didn't understand the politics of the moment and didn't especially care. He was on a Russian airbase, something he'd never expected to see except through a gun sight, but that was okay too. He thought for a moment that he rather liked Chinese food, especially the things they did to vegetables in a wok. But those were American Chinese, not the commie kind, and that, he figured, was that. He'd been in Russia for just over a day, long enough to turn down about 20 offers to snort down some vodka. Their fighter pilot seemed smart enough, maybe a little too eager for their own good, but friendly and respectful when they saw the four kills painted on the side panel of his F-15 Charlie, the lead fighter of the 390th Fighter Squadron. He hopped off the Russian jeep. They called it something else that he hadn't caught, at the foot of his fighter. His chief mechanic was there.
"Got her all ready for me, Chief?" Winters asked, as he took the first step on the ladder.
"You bet," replied Chief Master Sergeant Neil Nolan. "Everything is top-lined. She's as ready as I can make her. Go kill her some, Bronco."
It was a squadron rule that when a pilot had his hands on his aircraft, he went only by his call sign.
"I'll bring you the scalps, Nolan."
Colonel Winters continued his climb up the ladder, patting the decorated panel as he went. Chief Master Sergeant Nolan scurried up to help him strap in, then dropped off, detached the ladder, and got clear. Winters began his startup procedures, first of all entering his ground coordinates, something they still did on the Eagle despite the new GPS locator systems, because the F-15C had inertial navigation in case it broke. It never did, but procedure was procedure. The instruments came online telling Winters that his Eagle's conformal fuel tanks were topped off, and he had a full load of four AIM-120 MRAM radar-guided missiles, plus four more of the brand-new AIM-9X Sidewinders, the Super Snake version of a missile whose design went back to before his mom and dad had married in a church up on Lenox Avenue in Harlem.
"Tower, this is Bronco with three, ready to taxi. Over."
"Tower, Bronco, you are cleared to taxi. Wind is 305 at 10. Good luck, Colonel."
"Thank you, Tower. Bors, this is lead. Let's get going."
With that, he tripped his brakes and the fighter started moving, driven by its powerful Pratt & Whitney engines. A bunch of Russians, mainly ground crewmen, but judging by the outfits, some drivers as well, were out on the ramp watching him and his flight.
"Okay," he thought. "We'll show 'em how we do things downtown."
The four taxied in pairs to the end of the runway and then roared down the concrete slabs and pulled back into the air, wingmen tucked in tight. Seconds later, the other two pulled up and they turned south, already talking to the nearest AWACS, Eagle 2.
"Eagle 2, this is Boer Leader in the air with four."
"Boer Leader, this is Eagle 2. We have you. Come south, vector 170. Climb and maintain flight level 33. Looks like there's going to be some work for you today. Over."
"Suits me. Out."
Colonel Winters, he'd just been deep-dip selected for his bird as a full-bull colonel, wiggled a little in his seat to get things just right, and finished his climb to 33,000 feet. His radar system was off, and he wouldn't speak unnecessarily because someone out there might be listening. And why spoil the surprise? In a few minutes, he'd be entering the coverage of Chinese border radar stations. Somebody would have to do something about that. Later today, he hoped, the little weasel F-16s would go and see about those. But his job was Chinese fighter aircraft, and any bombers that might offer themselves. His orders were to remain over Russian airspace for the entire mission, and so if Joe Chink didn't want to come out and play, it would be a dull day. But Joe had Su-27s, and he thought those were pretty good. And Joe Chink, fighter pilot, probably thought he was pretty good, too. So they'd just have to see. Otherwise, it was a good day for flying, 2/10 clouds and nice, clean country air to fly in. His Falcon's eyes could see well over 100 miles from up here, and he had Eagle 2 to tell him where the Gomers were. Behind him, A second and third flight of four Eagles were each taking off. The wild boars would be fully represented today. The train ride was fairly jerky. Lieutenant Colonel Giusti squirmed in his upright coach seat, trying to get a little bit comfortable. But the Russian-made coach in which he and his staff were riding hadn't been designed with creature comforts in mind, and there was no sense grumbling about it. It was dark outside, the early morning that children sensibly take to be nighttime, and there wasn't much in the way of lights out there. They were in eastern Poland now, farm country probably, as Poland was evolving into the Iowa of Europe. Lots of pig farms to make the ham for which this part of the world was famous. Vodka, too, probably, and Colonel Giusti wouldn't have minded a snort of that at the moment. He stood and walked down the aisle of the car. Nearly everyone aboard was asleep or trying to be. Two sensible NCOs were stretched out on the floor instead of curled up on the seats. The dirty floor wouldn't do their uniforms much good, but they were heading to combat operations where neatness didn't really count all that much. Personal weapons were invariably stowed in the overhead racks, in the open for easy access, because they were all soldiers, and they didn't feel very comfortable without a usable weapon close by. He continued aft. The next coach had more troopers from headquarters company. His squadron sergeant major was in the back of that one, reading a paperback. "Hey, Colonel," the sergeant major said in greeting. "Long ride, ain't it? At least 3 more days to go, maybe 4. "Super," the senior non-com observed. "This is worse'n flying." "Yeah, well, at least we got our tracks with us." "Yes, sir." "How's the food situation?" "Well, sir, we all got our MREs, and I got me a big box of Snickers bars stashed." "Any word what's happening in the world?" "Just that it started in Siberia. The Chinese are across the border, and Ivan's trying to stop 'em. No details. We ought to get an update when we go through Moscow, after lunchtime, I expect." "Fair enough. How are the troopers taking things?" "No problems. Bored with the train ride. Want to get back in their tracks, the usual." "How's their attitude?" "They're ready, Colonel," the sergeant major assured him. "Good." With that, Giusti turned and headed back to his seat, hoping he'd get a few hours anyway. And there wasn't much of Poland to see anyway. The annoying part was being so cut off. He had satellite radios in his vehicles, somewhere on the flat cars aft of this coach, but he couldn't get to them, and without them he didn't know what was happening up forward. A war was on, he knew that, but it wasn't the same as knowing the details, knowing where the train would stop, where and when he'd get to offload his equipment, get the quarter horse organized, and get back on the road where they belonged. The train part was working well. The Russian train service seemingly had a million flat cars designed expressly to transport tracked vehicles, undoubtedly intended to take their battle tanks west, into Germany for a war against NATO. Little had the builders ever suspected that the cars would be used to bring American tanks east to help defend Russia against an invader. Well, nobody could predict the future more than a few weeks. At the moment, he would have settled for 5 days or so. The rest of First Armored was stretched back hundreds of miles on the east-west rail line. Colonel Don Lyle's 2nd Brigade was just finishing up boarding in Berlin, and would be tail-end Charlie for the division. They'd cross Poland in daylight, for what that was worth. The quarter horse was in the lead where it belonged. Wherever the drop-off point was, they'd set up perimeter security, and then lead the march farther east, in a maneuver called advance to contact, which was where the fun started. And he needed to be well rested for that, Colonel Giusti reminded himself. So he settled back in his seat and closed his eyes, surrendering his body to the jerks and sways of the train car. Dawn patrol was what fighter pilots all thought about. The title for the duty went back to a 1930s Errol Flynn movie,
and the term had probably originated with a real mission name, meaning to be the first up on a new day, to see the sunrise, and to seek out the enemy right after breakfast. Bronco Winters didn't look much like Errol Flynn, but that was okay. You couldn't tell a warrior by the look of his face, though you could tell by the look on his face. He was a fighter pilot. As a youngster in New York, he'd ride the subway to LaGuardia Airport, just to stand at the fence and watch the airplanes take off and land, knowing even then that he wanted to fly. He'd also known that fighters would be more fun than airliners, and known finally that to fly fighters he had to enter a service academy. And to do that, he'd have to study. And so he'd worked hard all through school, especially in math and science, because airplanes were mechanical things, and that meant that science determined how they worked. So he was something of a math whiz. That had been his college major at Colorado Springs. But his interest in it had ended the day he'd walked into Columbus Air Force Base in Mississippi, because once he got his hands on the controls of an aircraft, the study part of his mission was accomplished, and the learning part really began. He'd been the number one student in his class at Columbus, quickly and easily mastering the Cessna Tweety Bird trainer, and then moving on to fighters. And since he'd been number one in his class, he'd gotten his choice. And that choice, of course, had been the F-15 Eagle fighter, the strong and handsome grandson of the F-4 Phantom. An easy plane to fly, it was a harder one to fight, since the controls for the combat systems are located on the stick and the throttles, all in buttons of different shapes, so that you could manage all the systems by feel, and keep your eyes up and out of the aircraft instead of having to look down at instruments. It was something like playing two pianos at the same time, and it had taken Winters a disappointing 6 months to master. But now those controls came as naturally as twirling the wax into his Bismarck mustache, his one non-standard affectation, which he'd modeled on Robin Olds, a legend in the American fighter community, an instinctive pilot and a thinking, and therefore a very dangerous, tactician. An ace in World War II, an ace in Korea, and also an ace over North Vietnam, Olds was one of the best who'd ever strapped a fighter plane to his back, and one whose mustache had made Otto von Bismarck himself look like a pussy. Colonel Winters wasn't thinking about that now. The thoughts were there even so, as much a part of his character as his situational awareness, the part of his brain that kept constant track of the three-dimensional reality around him at all times. Flying came as naturally to him as it did to the Gerfalcon mascot at the Air Force Academy. And so did hunting. And now he was hunting. His aircraft had instrumentation that downloaded the take from the AWACS aircraft 150 miles to his rear, and he divided his eye time equally between the sky around him and the display 3 feet from his 20/10 brown eyes. There. 200 miles, bearing 172. 4 bandits heading north. Then 4 more. And another flight of 4. Joe Chink was coming up to play, and the pigs were hungry. Boar lead, this is Eagle 2. They were using encrypted burst transmission radios that were very difficult to detect and impossible to listen in on. Boar lead. But he kept his transmission short anyway. Why spoil the surprise? Boar lead, we have 16 bandits. 170, your position at Angels 30, coming due north at 500 knots. Got 'em. They're still south of the border, but not for long, the young controller on the E-3B advised. Boar, you are weapons free at this time.
Copy, weapons free, Colonel Winters acknowledged, and his left hand flipped a button to activate his systems. A quick look down to his weapon status display showed that everything was ready to fire. He didn't have his tracking targeting radar on, though it was in standby mode. The F-15 had essentially been designed as an appendage to the monstrous radar in its nose, a design consideration that had defined the size of the fighter from the first sketch on paper. But over the years, the pilots had gradually stopped using it, because it could warn an enemy with the right sort of threat receiver, telling him that there was an eagle in the neighborhood with open eyes and sharp claws. Instead, he could now cross-load the radar information from the AWACS, whose radar signals were unwelcome, but nothing an enemy could do anything about, and not directly threatening. The Chinese would be directed and controlled by ground radar, and the Boers were just at the fuzzy edge of that, maybe spotted, maybe not. Somewhere to his rear, a rivet joint EC-135 was monitoring both the radar and the radios used by the Chinese ground controllers, and would cross-load any warnings to the AWACS. But so far, none of that. So, Joe Chink was coming north. Eagle, Boer, say bandit type, over. Boer, we're not sure, but probably Sierra Uniform 27s by point of origin and flight profile, over. Roger. Okay, good, Winters thought. They thought the SU-27 was a pretty hot aircraft, and for a Russian-designed bird it was respectable. They put their best drivers into the flanker, and they'd be the proud ones, the ones who thought they were as good as he was. Okay, Joe, let's see how good you are. Boer, lead, come left to 135. 2, 3, 4, the flight acknowledged, and they all banked to the left. Winters took a look around to make sure he wasn't leaving any contrails to give away his position. Then he checked his threat receiver. It was getting some chirps from Chinese search radar, but still below the theoretical detection threshold. That would change in 20 miles or so. But then they'd just be unknowns on the Chinese screens, and fuzzy ones at that. Maybe the ground controllers would radio a warning, but maybe they'd just peer at their screens and try to decide if they were real contacts or not. The robin's egg blue of the Eagles wasn't all that easy to spot visually, especially when you had the sun behind you, which was the oldest trick in the fighter pilot Bible, and one for which there was still no solution. The Chinese passed to his right, 30 miles away, heading north and looking for Russian fighters to engage, because the Chinese would want to control the sky over the battlefield they'd just opened up. That meant that they'd be turning on their own search radars, and when that happened, they'd spend most of their time looking down at the scope instead of out at the sky, and that was dangerous. When he was south of them, Winters brought his flight right, west, and down to 20,000 feet, well below Joe Chink's cruising altitude, because fighter pilots might look back and up, but rarely back and down, because they'd been taught that height, like speed, was life. And so it was, most of the time. In another 3 minutes they were due south of the enemy, and Winters increased power to maximum dry thrust so as to catch up. His flight of four split on command into two pairs. He went left, and then his eyes spotted them, dark flecks on the brightening blue sky. They were painted the same light gray the Russians liked, and that would be a real problem if Russian flankers entered the area, because you didn't often get close enough to see if the wings had red stars or white-blue-red flags painted on them. The audio tone came next. His sidewinders could see the heat bloom from the Lyulka turbofan engines, and that meant he was just about close enough. His wingman, a clever young lieutenant, was now about 500 yards to his right, doing his job, which was covering his leader. Okay, Bronco Winters thought. He had a good 100 knots of overtake speed now. Boer, Eagle, be advised these guys are heading directly for us at the moment. Not for long, Eagle, Colonel Winters responded. They weren't flex anymore. Now they were twin-rudder fighter aircraft, cruising north, tucked in nice and pretty. His left forefinger selected Sidewinder to start, and the tone in his earphones was nice and loud. He'd start with two shots, one at the leftmost flanker, and the other at the rightmost, right about... Fox 2 with two birds away, Bronco reported. The smoke trails diverged, just as he wanted them to, streaking in on their targets. His gunsight camera was operating, and the picture was being recorded on videotape, just as it had been over Saudi the previous year. He needed one kill to make ace. He got the first 6 seconds later, and the next half a second after that. Both flankers tumbled right. The one on the left nearly collided with his wingman, but missed, and tumbled violently as pieces started coming off the airframe. The other one was rolling and then exploded into a nice white puffball. The first pilot ejected cleanly, but the second didn't. Tough luck, Joe, Winters thought. The remaining two Chinese fighters hesitated, but both then split and started maneuvering in diverging directions. Winters switched on his radar and followed the one to the left. He had radar lock, and it was well within the launch parameters for his AMRAAM. His right forefinger squeezed the pickle switch. Fox One, Fox One, slammer on guy to the west. He watched the slammer, as it was called, race in. Technically a fire-and-forget weapon, like the Sidewinder, it accelerated almost instantly to Mach 2+, and rapidly ate up the 3 miles between them. It only took about 10 seconds to close and explode a mere few feet over the fuselage of its target, and that flanker disintegrated with no chute coming away from it. Okay, three. This morning was really shaping up, but now the situation went back to World War I. He had to search for targets visually, and searching for jet fighters in a clear sky wasn't... there. You with me, Skippy? He called on the radio. Got you covered, Bronco, his wingman replied. Bandit at your 1 o'clock, going left or right. On him, Winters replied, putting his nose on the distant spot in the sky. His radar spotted it, locked onto it, and the IFF transponder didn't say friendly. He triggered off his second slammer. Fox One on the south guy. Eagle, Boer lead, how we doing? We show 5 kills to this point. Bandits are heading east and diving. Razorback is coming in from your west with 4, Angel 3-5 at 600, now at your 10 o'clock. Check your IFF, Boer lead. The controller was being careful, but that was okay. Boer, lead, check IFF now. 2, 3, 4, they all chimed in. Before the last of them confirmed his IFF transponder was in the transmit setting, his second slammer found its target, running his morning score to 4. Well, damn, Winters thought, this morning is really shaping up nice. Bronco, Skippy is on 1, his wingman reported, and Winters took position behind, low, and left of his wingman. Skippy was First Lieutenant Mario Acosta, a red-haired infant from Wichita who was coming along nicely for a child with only 200 hours in type. Fox 2 with 1, Skippy called. His target had turned south and was heading almost straight into the streaking missile. Winters saw the Sidewinder go right into his right-side intake, and the resulting explosion was pretty impressive. Eagle, Boer lead, give me a vector, over. Boer lead, come right at 090. I have a bandit at 10 miles and low, Angels 10, heading south at 600+. Winters executed the turn and checked his radar display. Got him. And this one also was well within the slammer envelope. Fox One with slammer. His 5th missile of the day leaped off the rail and rocketed east, angling down. And again Winters kept his nose on the target, ensuring that he'd get it on tape. Yes! That's a splash. Bronco has a splash. I think that's 5. Confirm 5 kills to Bronco, Eagle 2 confirmed. Nice going, buddy. What else is around? Boer lead, the bandits are running south on burner. Just went through Mach 1. We show a total of 9 kills plus 1 damage, with 6 bandits running back to the barn. Over. Roger, copy that, Eagle. Anything else happening at the moment? That's a negative, Boer lead. Where's the closest tanker? You can tank from Oliver 6, vector 005, distance 200, over. Roger that. Flight, this is Bronco. Let's assemble and head off to tank. Form up on me. 2, 3, 4. How we doing? Skippy has 1, his wingman reported. Ducky has 2, the second element leader chimed in. Ghost Man has 2 and a scratch. It didn't add up, Winters thought. Hell, maybe the AWACS guys got confused. That's why they had videotape. All in all, not a bad morning. Best of all, they'd put a real dent in the Tricom flanker inventory, and probably punched a pinhole in the confidence of their SU-27 drivers. Shaking up a fighter jock's confidence was almost as good as a kill, especially if they'd bagged the squadron commander. It would make the survivors mad, but it would make them question themselves, their doctrine, and their aircraft. And that was good.
So? The border defenses did about as well as one could reasonably expect, Colonel Aliyev replied. The good news is that most of our men escaped with their lives. Total dead is under 20, with 15 wounded.
What do they have across the river now?
Best guess, elements of 3 mechanized divisions. The Americans say that they now have 6 bridges completed and operating, so we can expect that number to increase rapidly. Chinese reconnaissance elements are pushing forward. We've ambushed some of them, but no prisoners yet. Their direction of advance is exactly what we anticipated, as is their speed of advance to this point.
Is there any good news? Bondarenko asked.
Oh, yes, General. Our Air Force and our American friends have given their Air Force a very bloody nose. We've killed over 30 of their aircraft with only 4 losses to this point, and 2 of the pilots have been rescued. We've captured 6 Chinese pilots. They're being taken west for interrogation. It's unlikely that they'll give us any really useful information, though I am sure the Air Force will want to grill them for technical things. Their plans and objectives are entirely straightforward, and they are probably right on or even slightly in advance of their plans.
None of this was a surprise to General Bondarenko, but it was unpleasant even so. His intelligence staff was doing a fine job of telling him what they knew and what they expected. But it was like getting a weather report in winter. Yes, it was cold, and yes, it was snowing. And no, the cold and the snow will probably not stop. And isn't it a shame you don't have a warm coat to wear? He had nearly perfect information, but no ability to do anything to change the news. It was all very good that his airmen were killing Chinese airmen, but it was the Chinese tanks and infantry carriers that he had to stop.
When will we be able to bring air power to bear on their spearheads?
We will start air-to-ground operations this afternoon with SU-31 ground attack aircraft, Aliyev replied.
But what? Bondarenko demanded.
But isn't it better to let them come in with minimal interference for a few days? It was a courageous thing for his operations officer to say. It was also the right thing, Gennady Yosifovich realized on reflection. If his only strategic option was to lay a deep trap, then why waste what assets he had before the trap was fully set? This was not the Western Front in June of 1941. And he didn't have Stalin sitting in Moscow with a figurative pistol to his head. No, in Moscow now, the government would be raising all manner of political hell, probably calling for an emergency meeting of the United Nations Security Council. But that was just advertising. It was his job to defeat these yellow barbarians, and doing that was a matter of using what power he had in the most efficient manner possible. And that meant drawing them out. It meant making their commander as confident as a schoolyard bully looking down at a child 5 years his junior. It meant giving them what the Japanese had once called the victory disease. Make them feel invincible, and then leap at them like a tiger dropping from a tree.
Andrei, only a few aircraft, and tell them not to risk themselves by pressing their attacks too hard. We can hurt their air force, but their ground forces... We let them keep their advantage for a while. Let them get fat on this fine table set before them for a while.
I agree, Comrade General. It's a hard pill to swallow, but in the end, harder for them to eat, assuming our political leadership allows us to do the right thing.
Yes, that is the real issue at hand, isn't it?
Chapter 52. Deep Battle. General Peng crossed over into Russia in his command vehicle, well behind the 1st Regiment of heavy tanks. He thought of using a helicopter, but his operations staff warned him that the air battle was not going as well as the featherheads in the PLA-AF had told him to expect.
He felt uneasy, crossing the river in an armored vehicle on a floating bridge, like a brick tied to a balloon. But he did so, listening as his operations officer briefed him on the progress to this point. The Americans have surged a number of fighter aircraft forward, and along with them their E-3 airborne radar fighter control aircraft. These are formidable and difficult to counter, though our Air Force colleagues say that they have tactics to deal with them. I will believe that when I see it, Colonel Waugh observed. But that is the only bad news so far. We are several hours ahead of schedule. Russian resistance is lighter than I expected. The prisoners we've taken are very disheartened at their lack of support. Is that a fact? Peng asked, as they left the ribbon bridge and thumped down on Russian soil. Yes, we have 10 men captured from their defensive positions. We'll see them in a few minutes. They had escape tunnels and personnel carriers set to evacuate the men. They didn't expect to hold for long, Colonel Waugh went on. They planned to run away, rather than defend to the last as we expected. I think they lack the heart for combat, Comrade General. That information got Peng's attention. It was important to know the fighting spirit of one's enemy. Did any of them stand and fight to the end? Only one of their bunker positions. It cost us 30 men, but we took them out. Perhaps their escape vehicle was destroyed and they had no choice, the colonel speculated. I want to see one of these positions at once, Peng ordered. Of course, Comrade General. Wah ducked inside and shouted an order to the track driver. The Type 90 armored personnel carrier lurched to the right, surprising the MP who was trying to do traffic control. But he didn't object. The 4 tall radio whips told him what sort of track this was. The command carrier moved off the beaten track directly toward an intact Russian bunker. General Peng got out, ducking his head as he did so, and walked toward the mainly intact old gun turret. The inverted frying pan shape told him that this was off an old Stalin III tank. A very formidable vehicle once upon a time, but now an obvious relic. A team of intelligence specialists was there. They snapped to attention when they saw the general approach. "What did we kill it with?" Peng asked. "We didn't, Comrade General. They abandoned it after firing 15 cannon shots and about 300 machine gun rounds. They didn't even destroy it before we captured it," the intelligence captain reported, waving the general down the tank hatch. "It's safe. We checked for booby traps." Peng climbed down. He saw what appeared to be a comfortable small barracks, shell storage for their big tank gun, ample rounds for their 2 machine guns. There were empty rounds for both types of guns on the floor, along with wrappers for field rations. It appeared to be a comfortable position, with bunks, shower, toilet, and plenty of food storage. Something worth fighting for, the general thought. "How did they leave?" Peng asked. "This way," the young captain said, leading him north into the tunnel. "You see, the Russians planned for everything." The tunnel led under the crest of the hill to a covered parking pad for, probably for a BTR, it looked like, confirmed by the wheel tracks on the ground immediately off the concrete pad. "How long did they hold?" "We took the place just less than 3 hours after our initial bombardment. So we had infantry surrounding the main gun emplacement, and soon thereafter they ran away," the captain told his army commander. "I see. Good work by our assault infantry." Then Peng saw that Colonel Waugh had brought his command track over the hill to the end of the escape tunnel, allowing him to hop right aboard. "Now what?" Waugh asked. "I want to see what we did to their artillery support positions." Wah nodded and relayed the orders to the track commander. That took 15 minutes of bouncing and jostling. The 15 heavy guns were still there, though the 2 Peng passed had been knocked over and destroyed by counter-battery fire. The position they visited was mainly intact, though a number of rockets had fallen close aboard,
near enough that three bodies were still lying there untended next to their guns, the bodies surrounded by sticky pools of mainly dried blood. More men had survived, probably. Close to each gun was a 2-meter-deep, narrow trench lined with concrete that the bombardment hadn't done more than chip. Close by also was a large ammo storage bunker with rails on which to move the shells and propellant charges to the guns. The door was open. "How many rounds did they get off?" he asked. "No more than 10, another intelligence officer, this one a major, replied. "Our counter-battery fire was superb here. The Russian battery was 15 guns total. One of them got off 20 shots, but that was all. We had them out of action in less than 10 minutes. The artillery tracker radars worked brilliantly, Comrade General." Peng nodded agreement. "So it would appear. This emplacement would have been fine 20 or 30 years ago, good protection for the gunners and a fine supply of shells. But they did not anticipate an enemy with the ability to pinpoint their gun so rapidly. If it stands still, Wah, you can kill it." Peng looked around. "Still, the engineers who sighted this position and the other one, they were good. It's just that this sort of thing is out of date. What were our total casualties?"
"Killed 350, thereabouts. Wounded 620, operations replied. "It was not exactly cheap, but less than we expected. If the Russians had stood and fought, it could have been far worse."
"Why did they run so soon?" Peng asked. "Do we know?"
"We found a written order in one of the bunkers, authorizing them to leave when they thought things were untenable."
"That surprised me," Colonel Waugh observed.
"Historically, the Russians fight very hard on the defense, as the Germans found. But that was under Stalin. The Russians had discipline then. And courage. Not today, it would seem."
"Their evacuation was conducted with some skill," Peng thought out loud. "We ought to have taken more prisoners."
"They ran too fast, Comrade General," operations explained.
"He who fights and runs away," Colonel Peng quoted, "lives to fight another day. Bear that in mind, Colonel."
"Yes, Comrade General, but he who runs away is not an immediate threat."
"Let's go," the general said, heading off to his command track. He wanted to see the front, such as it was.
"So?" Bondarenko asked the lieutenant.
The youngster had been through a bad day, and being required to stand and make a report to his theater commander made it no better.
"Stand easy, boy. You're alive. It could have been worse."
"General, we could have held if we'd been given a little support," Komonov said, allowing his frustration to appear.
"There was none to give you. Go on."
The general pointed at the map on the wall.
"They crossed here, and came through this saddle, and over this ridge to attack us. Leg infantry, no vehicles that we ever saw. They had man-portable anti-tank weapons, nothing special or unexpected, but they had massive artillery support. There must have been an entire battery concentrated just on my one position. Heavy guns, 15 centimeter or more. And artillery rockets that wiped out our artillery support almost immediately."
"That's the one surprise they threw at us," Aliyev confirmed. "They must have a lot more of those firefinder systems than we expected. And they're using their Type 83 rockets as dedicated counter-battery weapons, like the Americans did in Saudi. It's an effective tactic. We'll have to go after their counter-battery systems, first of all, or use self-propelled guns to fire and move after only 2 or 3 shots. There's no way to spoof them that I know of, and jamming radars of that type is extremely difficult."
"So we have to work on a way to kill them early on," Bondarenko said. "We have electronic intelligence units. Let them seek out those Chink radars and eliminate them with rockets of our own."
He turned.
"Go on, Lieutenant. Tell me about the Chinese infantry."
"They are not cowards, Comrade General. They take fire and act properly under it. They are well drilled. My position and the one next to us took down at least 200, and they kept coming. Their battle drill is quite good, like a soccer team. If you do this, they do that, almost instantly. For certain, they call in artillery fire with great skill.
They had the batteries already lined up, Lieutenant, lined up and waiting, Aliyev told the junior officer. It helps if you are following a prepared script. Anything else? We never saw a tank. They had us taken out before they finished their bridges. Their infantry looked well prepared, well trained, even eager to move forward. I did not see evidence of flexible thinking, but I did not see much of anything. And as you say, their part of the operation was pre-planned and thoroughly rehearsed. Typically, the Chinese tell their men a good deal about their planned operations beforehand. They don't believe in secrecy the way we do, Aliyev said. Perhaps it makes for comradely solidarity on the battlefield.
But things are going their way, Andrei. The measure of an army is how it reacts when things go badly. We haven't seen that yet, however.
And would they ever? Bondarenko wondered. He shook his head. He had to banish that sort of thinking from his mind. If he had no confidence, how could his men have it?
What about your men, Valery Mikhailovich? How did they fight?
We fought, Comrade General, Komonov assured the senior officer. We killed 200, and we would have killed many more with a little artillery support.
Will your men fight some more? Aliyev asked.
Fuck yes, Komonov snarled back. Those little bastards are invading our country. Give us the right weapons and we'll fucking kill them all.
Did you graduate tank school? Komonov bobbed his head like a cadet.
Yes, Comrade General, 8th in my class.
Give him a company with Boyar, the general told his ops officer. They're short of officers. Major General Marion Diggs was in the third train out of Berlin. It wasn't his choosing, just the way things worked out. He was 30 minutes behind Angelo Giusti's cavalry squadron. The Russians were running their trains as closely together as safety allowed, and probably even shading that somewhat. What was working was that the Russian national train system was fully electrified, which meant that the engines accelerated well out of stations and out of the slow orders caused by track problems, which were numerous. Diggs had grown up in Chicago. His father had been a Pullman porter with the Atchison, Topeka, and Santa Fe Railroad, working the superchief between Chicago and Los Angeles until the passenger service had died in the early 1970s. Then, remarkably enough, he'd changed unions to become an engineer. Marion remembered riding with him as a boy, and loving the feel of such a massive piece of equipment under his hands. And so, when he'd gone to West Point, he decided to be a tanker, and, better yet, a cavalryman. Now he owned a lot of heavy equipment. It was his first time in Russia, a place he certainly hadn't expected to see when he'd been in the first half of his uniformed career, when the Russians he'd worried about seeing had been mainly from 1st Guards Tank and 3rd Shock Armies. Those massive formations that had once sat in East Germany, always poised to take a nice little drive to Paris. Or so NATO had feared. But no more now that Russia was part of NATO, an idea that was like something from a bad science fiction movie. There was no denying it, however. Looking out the windows of the train car, he could see the onion-topped spires of Russian Orthodox churches, ones that Stalin had evidently failed to tear down. The rail yards were pretty familiar. Never the most artistic examples of architecture or city planning. They looked the same as the dreary yards leading into Chicago or any other American city. No, only the train yards that you built under your Christmas tree every year were pretty. But they didn't have any Christmas trees in evidence here. The train rolled to a stop, probably waiting for a signal to proceed. But no, this looked to be some sort of military terminal. Russian tanks were in evidence off to the right, and a lot of sloped concrete ramps. The Russians had probably built this place to ship their own tracked vehicles west, he judged.
General, a voice called.
Yo!
Somebody here to see you, sir, the same voice announced.
Diggs stood and walked back to the sound. It was one of his junior staff officers, a new one fresh from Leavenworth, and behind him was a Russian general officer.
"You are Diggs?" the Russian asked in fair English.
"That's right.
Come with me, please."
The Russian walked out onto the platform. The air was fresh, but they were under low gray clouds this morning.
"You going to tell me how things are going out east?" Diggs asked.
"We wish to fly you and some of your staff to Chabarsaville so that you can see for yourself."
That made good sense, Diggs thought.
"How many?"
"Six, plus you."
"Okay."
The general nodded and reached for the captain, who'd summoned him from his seat.
"I want Colonels Masterman, Douglas, Welch, Turner, Major Hurst, and Lieutenant Colonel Garvey."
"Yes, sir."
The boy disappeared.
"How soon?"
"The transport is waiting for you now."
One of theirs, Diggs thought.
He'd never flown on a Russian aircraft before. How safe would it be? How safe would it be to fly into a war zone? Well, the army didn't pay him to stay in safe places.
"Who are you?"
"Nosenko. Valentin Nosenko. General Major Stavka."
"How bad is it?"
"It is not good, General Diggs. Our main problem will be getting reinforcements to the theater of action. But they have rivers to cross. The difficulties, as you Americans say, should even out."
Diggs's main worry was supply. His tanks and Bradleys all had basic ammo loads already aboard, and 2.5 additional such loads for each vehicle were on supply trucks sitting on other trains like this one. After that, things got a little worrisome, especially for artillery. But the biggest worry of all was diesel fuel. He had enough to move his division maybe 300 or 400 miles. That was a good long way in a straight line, but wars never allowed troops to travel in straight lines. That translated to maybe 200 miles of actual travel at best, and that was not an impressive number at all. Then there was the question of jet fuel for his organic aircraft. So his head logistician, Colonel Ted Douglas, was the first guy he needed, after Masterman, his operations brain. The officers started showing up.
"What gives, sir?" Masterman asked.
"We're flying east to see what's going on."
"Okay, let me make sure we have some communications gear."
Masterman disappeared again. He left the train car along with 2 enlisted men humping satellite radio equipment.
"Good call, Duke," LTC Garvey observed. He was communications and electronic intelligence for First Tanks.
"Gentlemen, this is General Nosenko from Stavka. He's taking us east, I gather."
"Correct. I am an intelligence officer for Stavka. This way, please."
He led them off to where 4 cars were waiting. The drive to a military airport took 20 minutes.
"How are your people taking this?" Diggs asked.
"The civilians, you mean?"
"Too soon to tell. Much disbelief, but some anger."
"Anger is good," Nosenko said. "Anger gives courage and determination."
If the Russians were talking about anger and determination, the situation must be pretty bad, Diggs thought, looking out at the streets of the Moscow suburbs.
"What are you moving east ahead of us?"
"So far, 4 motor rifle divisions," Nosenko answered. "Those are our best prepared formations. We are assembling other forces."
"I've been out of touch. What else is NATO sending? Anything?" Diggs asked next.
"A British brigade is forming up now, the men based at Horna. We hope to have them on the way here in 2 days.
"No way we'd go into action without at least the Brits to back us up," Diggs said.
"Good. They're equipped about the same way we are."
And better yet, they trained according to the same doctrine.
Horna, he thought. Their 22nd Brigade from Hague Barracks, Brigadier Sam Turner. Drank whiskey like it was Perrier, but a good thinker and a superior tactician. And his brigade was all trained up from some fun and games down at Grafenvoor.
"What about Germans?"
"That's a political question," Nosenko admitted.
"Tell your politicians that Hitler's dead, Valentin. The Germans are pretty good to have on your side. Trust me, buddy. We play with them all the time. They're down a little from 10 years ago, but the German soldier ain't no dummy, and neither are his officers. Their reconnaissance units are particularly good."
Yes, but that is a political question, Nozenko repeated. And that, Diggs knew, was that. At least for now. The aircraft waiting was an IL-86, known to NATO as the Camber, manifestly the Russian copy of Lockheed's C-141 Starlifter. This one had Aeroflot commercial markings, but retained the gun position in the tail that the Russians liked to keep on all their tactical aircraft. Diggs didn't object to it at the moment. They'd scarcely had the chance to sit down and strap in when the aircraft started rolling.
In a hurry, Valentin?
Why wait, General Diggs? There's a war on, he reminded his guest.
Okay, what do we know?
Nozenko opened the map case he'd been carrying and laid out a large sheet on the floor as the aircraft lifted off. It was of the Chinese-Russian border on the Amur River, with markings already penciled in. The American officers all leaned over to look.
They came in here and drove across the river.
How fast are they moving? Bondarenko asked.
I have a reconnaissance company ahead of them. They report in every 15 minutes, Colonel Tolkanov replied. They are moving in a deliberate manner. Their reconnaissance screen is composed of WZ-501 tracked APCs, heavy on radios, light on weapons. They are on the whole not very enterprising, however. As I said, deliberate. They move by leapfrogging half a kilometer at a bound, depending on terrain. We are monitoring their radios. They are not encrypted, though their spoken language is deceptive in terminology. We are working on that.
Speed of advance?
5 kilometers in an hour is the fastest we've seen, usually slower than that. Their main body is still getting organized, and they haven't set up a logistics train yet. I'd expect them to attempt no more than 30 kilometers in a day on flat open ground, based on what I've seen so far.
Interesting.
Bondarenko looked back at his maps. They'd start going north-northwest because that's what the terrain compelled them to do. At this speed, they'd be at the gold strike in 6 or 7 days. Theoretically, he could move 265th motor rifle to a blocking position. Here. In 2 days, and make a stand. But by then, they'd have at least 3, maybe 8 mechanized divisions to attack his 1 full-strength unit. And he couldn't gamble on that so soon. The good news was that the Chinese were bypassing his command post. Contemptuously, he wondered. Or just because there was nothing there to threaten them, and so nothing to squander force on. No, they'd run as fast and hard as they could, bringing up foot infantry to wall off their line of advance. That was classic tactics, and the reason was because it worked. Everyone did it that way, from Hannibal to Hitler. So their lead elements moved deliberately, and they were still forming up their army over the Amur bridgehead.
What units have we identified?
The lead enemy formation is their 34th Red Banner Shock Army, commanded by Peng Shiwang. He is politically reliable and well-regarded in Beijing, an experienced soldier. Expect him to be the operational army group commander. The 34th Army is mainly across the river now. 3 more Group A mechanized armies are lined up to cross as well, the 31st, 29th, and 43rd. That's a total of 16 mechanized divisions, plus a lot of other attachments. We think the 65th Group B Army will be next to cross. 4 infantry divisions plus a tank brigade. Their job will be to hold the western flank, I would imagine.
That made sense. There was no Russian force east of the breakthrough worthy of the name. A classic operation would also wheel east to Vladivostok on the Pacific coast, but that would only distract forces from the main objective. So the turn east would wait for at least a week, probably 2 or 3, with just light screening forces heading that way for the moment.
What about our civilians? Bondarenko asked.
They're leaving the towns in the Chinese path as best they can, mainly cars and buses. We have MP units trying to keep them organized. So far nothing has happened to interfere with the evacuation, Tolkanov said. See, from this it looks as if they're actually bypassing Belogorsk, just passing east of it with their reconnaissance elements.
Oh, that's the smart move, isn't it? Bondarenko observed.
Their real objective is far to the north. Why slow down for anything? They don't want land. They don't want people. They want oil and gold. Capturing civilians will not make those objectives any easier to accomplish. If I were this Peng fellow, I would be worried about the extent of my drive north. Even unopposed, the natural obstacles are formidable, and defending his line of advance will be a beast of a problem.
Gennady paused. Why have any sympathy for this barbarian? His mission was to kill him and all his men, after all. But how? If even marching that far north was a problem, and it was, then how much harder would it be to strike through the same terrain with less prepared troops? The tactical problems on both sides were the kind men in his profession did not welcome.
"General Bondarenko?" a foreign voice asked.
"Yes?"
He turned to see a man dressed in an American flight suit.
"Sir, my name is Major Dan Tucker. I just flew in with a downlink for our Dark Star UAVs. Where do you want us to set up, sir?"
"Colonel Tolkunov."
"Major, this is my chief of intelligence."
The American saluted sloppily, as Air Force people tended to do.
"Howdy, Colonel."
"How long to set up?"
The American was pleased that this Tolkunov's English was better than his own Russian.
"Less than an hour, sir."
"This way."
The G-2 led him outside.
"How good are your cameras?"
"Colonel, when a guy's out taking a piss, you can see how big his dick is." Tolkunov figured that was typical American braggadocio, but it set him wondering. Captain Fyodor Ilyich Alexandrov commanded the 265th Motor Rifles Divisional Reconnaissance Element. The division was supposed to have a full battalion for this task, but he was all they had. And for that task, he had 8 of the new BRM reconnaissance tracks. These were evolutionary developments of the standard BMP infantry combat vehicle, upgraded with better automotive gear, more reliable engine and transmission systems, plus the best radios his country made. He reported directly to his divisional commander, and also, it seemed, to the theater intelligence coordinator, some colonel named Tolkunov. That chap, he'd discovered, was very concerned with his personal safety, always urging him to stay close, but not too close, not to be spotted, and to avoid combat of any type. His job, Tolkunov had told him at least once every 2 hours for the last day and a half, was to stay alive and to keep his eye on the advancing Chinese. He wasn't supposed to so much as injure one little hair on their cute little chink heads, just stay close enough that if they mumbled in their sleep, to copy down the names of the girlfriends they fucked in their dreams. Alexandrov was a young captain, only 28, and rakishly handsome, an athlete who ran for personal pleasure. And running, he told his men, was the best form of exercise for a soldier, especially a reconnaissance specialist. He had a driver, gunner, and radio operator for each of his tracks, plus 3 infantrymen whom he'd personally trained to be invisible. The drill was for them to spend about half their time out of their vehicles, usually a good kilometer or so ahead of their Chinese counterparts, either behind trees or on their bellies, reporting back with monosyllabic comments on their portable radios, which were of Japanese manufacture. The men moved light, carrying only their rifles and 2 spare magazines, because they weren't supposed to be seen or heard. And the truth was that Alexandrov would have preferred to send them out unarmed, lest they be tempted to shoot someone out of patriotic anger. However, no soldier would ever stand for being sent out on a battlefield weaponless, and so he'd had to settle for ordering them out with bolts closed on empty chambers. The captain was usually out with his men, their BRM carriers hidden 300 or so meters away in the trees. In the past 24 hours, they'd become intimately familiar with their Chinese opponents. These were also trained and dedicated reconnaissance specialists, and they were pretty good at their jobs, or certainly appeared to be. They were also moving in tracked vehicles, and also spent a lot of their time on foot, ahead of their tracks, hiding behind trees and peering to the north, looking for Russian forces. The Russians had even started giving them names.
"It's the gardener,"
Sergeant Buikov said. That one liked touching trees and bushes, as though studying them for a college paper or something. The gardener was short and skinny, and looked like a 12-year-old to the Russians. He seemed competent enough, carrying his rifle slung on his back and using his binoculars often. He was a Chinese lieutenant, judging by his shoulder boards, probably commander of this platoon. He ordered his people around a lot, but didn't mind taking the lead. So he was probably conscientious. He is, therefore, the one we should kill first, Alexandrov thought. Their BRM reconnaissance track had a fine 30-millimeter cannon that could reach out and turn the gardener into fertilizer from 1,000 meters or so. But Captain Alexandrov had forbidden it. Worse luck, Buikov thought. He was from this area, a woodsman of sorts who'd hunted in the forests many times with his father, a lumberjack.
We really ought to kill him. Boris Yevgenievich, do you wish to alert the enemy to our presence? Alexandrov asked his sergeant.
I suppose not, my captain, but the hunting season is...
Closed, sergeant. The season is closed, and no, he is not a wolf that you can shoot for your own pleasure. And...
Down, Alexandrov ordered.
The gardener was looking their way with his field glasses. Their faces were painted, and they had branches tucked into their field clothing to break up their outlines. But he was taking no chances.
They'll be moving soon. Back to the track.
The hardest part of their drill was to avoid leaving tracks for the Chinese to spot. Alexandrov had discussed this with his drivers, threatening to shoot anyone who left a trail. He knew he couldn't do that, of course, but his men weren't quite sure. Their vehicles even had upgraded mufflers to reduce their sound signature. Every so often, the men who designed and built Russian military equipment got things right, and this was such a case. Besides, they didn't crank their engines until they saw the Chinese doing the same. Alexandrov looked up. Okay, the gardener was waving to those behind him, the wave that meant to bring their vehicles up. They were doing another leapfrog jump, with one section standing fast and providing overwatch cover for the next move, should something happen. He had no intention of making anything happen, but of course they couldn't know that. Alexandrov was surprised that they were maintaining their careful drill into the second day. They weren't getting sloppy yet. He'd expected that, but it seemed that the Chinese were better drilled even than his expectations, and were assiduously following their written doctrine. Well, so was he.
"Move now, Captain?" Buikov asked.
"No, let's sit still and watch. They ought to stop at that little ridge with the logging road. I want to see how predictable they are, Boris Yevgenievich."
But he did trigger his portable radio.
"Stand by. They're jumping again."
The other radio just clicked on and off, creating a whisper of static, rather than a spoken reply.
Good. His men were adhering to their radio discipline.
The second echelon of Chinese tracks moved forward carefully, at about 10 kilometer speed, following this opening in the forest. Interesting, he thought, that they weren't venturing too far into the adjoining woods, no more than 200 or 300 meters. Then he cringed. A helicopter chattered overhead. It was a Gazelle, a Chinese copy of the French military helicopter. But his track was back in the woods, and every time it stopped, the men ran outside to stretch the camo net around it. His men also were well drilled. And that, he told his men, was why they didn't dare leave a visible trail if they wanted to live. It wasn't much of a helicopter, but it did carry rockets. And their BRM was an armored personnel carrier. But it wasn't that armored.
"What's he doing?" Buikov asked.
"If he's looking, he's not being very careful about it."
The Chinese were driving up a pathway built ages ago for an unbuilt spur off the Trans-Siberian Railroad. It was wide, in some places 500 meters, and fairly well graded. Someone in years past had thought about building this spur to exploit the unsurveyed riches of Siberia,
enough to cut down a lot of trees, and they'd barely grown back in the harsh winters. Just saplings in this pathway now, easily ground into splinters by tracked vehicles. Farther north, the work was being continued by Army engineers, making a path to the new gold find, and beyond that to the oil discoveries on the Arctic coast. When they got that far, the Chinese would find a good road, ready-made for a mechanized force to exploit. But it was a narrow one, and the Chinese would have to learn about flank security if they kept this path up. Alexandrov remembered a Roman adventure into Germany. A soldier named Quintilius Varus, commanding 3 legions, who'd ignored his flanks, and lost his army in the process to a German named Arminius. Might the Chinese make a similar mistake? No, everyone knew of the Teutoburg forest disaster. It was a textbook lesson in every military academy in the known world. Quintilius Varus had been a political commander, given that command because he'd been beloved of his emperor, Caesar Augustus, obviously not because of his operational skill. It was a lesson probably better remembered by soldiers than by politicians. And the Chinese army was commanded by soldiers, wasn't it?
That's the fox, Buikov said.
This was the other officer in the Chinese unit, probably the subordinate of the gardener. Similar in size, but he had less interest in plants than he had in darting about. As they watched, he disappeared into the tree line to the east, and if he went by the form card, he'd be invisible for 5 to 8 minutes.
I could use a smoke, Sergeant Buikov observed.
That will have to wait, Sergeant.
Yes, Comrade Captain.
May I have a sip of water, then? He asked petulantly.
It wasn't water he wanted, of course.
Yes, I'd like a shot of vodka, too, but I neglected to bring any with me, as I am sure you did as well.
Regrettably, yes, Comrade Captain. A good slug of vodka helps keep the chill away in these damp woods.
And it also dulls the senses. And we need our senses, Boris Yevgenievich, unless you enjoy eating rice. Assuming the Chinks take prisoners, which I rather doubt. They do not like us, Sergeant, and they are not a civilized people, remember that.
So they don't go to the ballet. Neither do I, Sergeant Buikov didn't say aloud. His captain was a Muscovite and spoke often of cultural matters. But, like his captain, Buikov had no love for the Chinese, and even less now that he was looking at Chinese soldiers on the soil of his country. He only regretted not killing some, but killing was not his job. His job was watching them piss on his country, which somehow only made him angrier.
"Captain, will we ever get to shoot them?"
the sergeant asked.
"In due course, yes, it will be our job to eliminate their reconnaissance elements, and yes, Boris, I look forward to that as well."
And yes, I could use a smoke as well, and I'd love a glass of vodka right now.
But he'd settle for some black bread and butter, which he did have in his track, 300 meters to the north. 6.5 minutes this time. The fox had at least looked into the woods to the east, probably listened for the sound of diesel engines, but heard nothing but the chirping of birds. Still, this Chink lieutenant was the more conscientious of the two, in Buikov's opinion. They should kill him first when the time came, the sergeant thought. Alexandrov tapped the sergeant on the shoulder.
Our turn to leapfrog, Boris Yevgenievich.
By your command, Comrade Captain.
And both men moved out, crouching for the first 100 meters, and taking care not to make too much noise, until they heard the Chinese tracks start their engines. In 5 more minutes, they were back in their BRM and heading north, slowly picking their way through the trees. Alexandrov buttered some bread and ate it, sipping water as he did so. When they'd traveled 1,000 meters, their vehicle stopped, and the captain got on his big radio.
"Who is Ingrid?"